Good evening.
I think we're up and running, everybody. It's Wednesday night. It's 7 o'clock. We're on the west coast of the United States. And we are working diligently to get to a bit of understanding, to incorporate a bit of understanding in a pragmatic manner so that we can carry it around like a bracelet on our wrist, something that immediate, so that this material becomes alive and actually becomes a living teaching. And it becomes a living teaching when each of us make it into a living teaching. It is words on a piece of paper until that moment. And we have a unique opportunity because we get to do that together. And that's going to be I'm going to focus on that point about a third of the way in tonight. There's a very important point I want to make about that. So there you go. So Ivan, you're here.
Yeah.
Molly's here. And is Susan here, by the way? Susan, are you on the line?
Hello, I'm here.
Susan?
She's there.
Although I'm here, but my computer's not here.
Well,
so I only have you by telephone.
Well, we really appreciate the fact that you've come nevertheless, okay?
Yeah, me too.
Do you have your book with you?
I do.
Okay, well, you're set, buddy.
Yeah.
So, no computer, we get you, and Molly will raise her hand if she needs something needs to be spoken of, and I think Pianjo is back again from the depths of non-computer land, so welcome back, and welcome to everybody that's out there. This is a lot of information is in this book, and we're most of our way through it. We're just a few weeks away from the ending, actually. But I want to comment on something that I made, I put in the email. I'm not sure. Do you actually get that email, Ivan?
I usually do.
Okay.
I don't think I got this one today.
Well, if you usually do, then you did get it.
Okay.
But I sent it out Monday night.
Oh.
The point of it is that the material that's being discussed here is utterly unique. And I am not aware of anybody else that is speaking at all, really, about the fundamental elements in macrodimensional voyaging. And that's what we're talking about. So we actually are in a moment of history unusual. All the scholars that are on the line tonight can comment on that, including George and Pianjo, and comment on the fact that is there other literature like this? Maybe there is in some of the more esoteric Tibetan, where they're talking about the Bardo Todol and some of that, but I've not seen it. This is actually material that is discussing this kind of work openly. George, does that, or Silverdale, does that make sense to you, what I'm saying?
Hey, it sure does. This is definitely near the top of the mountain where our view is expanded 360 degrees. To get there, of course, is not so easy.
Yeah, and it hasn't been easy for us to get to this point. I don't know how many people are viewing.
Yeah, online.
So there's like 17, 18, 19, 20 people tonight. To get to this material at all has taken us a lot of work. I don't think we could have gotten here, Ivan, directly. We had to work our way through the HBM.
Mm-hmm.
Then we actually, in my opinion, and that's why I chose it, we had to go to Joy of Sacrifice as the next volume, because that began to open up our hearts in thinking about this. And this material is material that is dependent on mood and being able to open up in that manner. So that was just an introductory point about the uniqueness of this literature. Life in the Labyrinth by E.J. Gold. We're on chapter 15 now. And Ivan, would you get us started and read the header there, please?
Okay. Going macro-dimensional. Often, when we think that we are at our best, we are at our worst. And when we believe we're at our worst, we are at our best. But we can be assured that if we are in the macro dimensions with presence and attention, always and automatically our functioning in the work chamber conforms to law. We cannot help but be correct.
Okay, let me put that in context. This is the last phrase there is a staggering principle. Last week, we read about the quatrain, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in that chapter, at the beginning of the chapter, says, this is the most powerful tool that a macro-dimensional voyager, the Labyrinth Voyager, has. Right?
Yeah.
And now here, at the end of this header, it says, with presence and attention, always and automatically, our functioning in the work chamber conforms to law. Boom. It's like another, these are small, subtle instructions that if we can take them to heart, they are powerful tools in our work. Because most of the people that are on tonight work and live individually. They don't live in a group. They don't live in a community. So each of us has to go out into the world on our own, in a sense.
Right. Yeah, I guess it's on our own.
Well,
it's a good point you're making that this is a team effort here.
Absolutely.
We're getting a chance to work with a team, with a pack of greens, so to speak.
Okay, so recall the fact and note the fact that right now we are as a team. We're gathering as a team, and the team is starting to form. Right now there's like 19 of us as individuals. As the hour progresses, we will become a team. All right? I'm not sure if we're going to get through this whole chapter tonight because there's a lot of material. let's just get us going here. I'm going to start with the second paragraph. The competent voyager gradually becomes aware of subtle signals beckoning to us to venture into dangerous dimensions. So I was struck by this phrase, subtle signals.
Mm-hmm.
What, George or Silverdale, what does that mean to what it? How do we take that?
You know, Dave, what I'm working on is the development of my essential self, which identifies itself as a vibratory sensation. And it becomes almost like a language of sensing and feeling vibrational frequencies. And so for me, this speaks of to what degree can you resonate with another chamber, which might be an individual or it might be a set of circumstances.
Let's pay attention to the phrase, the actual term here, subtle signals. So as you're doing your work and you've used the terminology of a vibratory sensation a number of times, so that comes to bear. But what our job here is we want to point to the subtle signals. We want to point to those subtle signals and, in a sense, invite them out of the shadows. Invite those signals out of the shadow. Okay?
There's that. The competent voyager. So
yeah.
Hence that's what Silverdale is referring to, I think.
And
the attention and presence are functioning. You know, the essential is in this kind of conformity.
Are we talking about the subtle signs that you're entering a higher dimension, such as
yes.
the change of, you know, context and color and feeling?
Yeah, things like that. I think from a, and Silverdale, correct me if I'm off here, but it's when the weight of the presence and attention of the essential self starts to take a more prominent position, and we start to move more in that direction, there are subtle signs that will occur. Our job this evening, and actually in our work together as a team, is to name those subtle signs. And Susan, you named a few with the texture, the color, the lighting, the quality of the lighting, the atmosphere.
Right.
And then we call that out.
And, it's also important to point out that, look, we're all familiar with our historical personality, which is a very much of a mechanized machine that instinctively reacts in accordance with predetermined patterns of behavior. And what we're trying to do is develop our essential self, which senses and feels things and therefore has a more comprehensive and subtle perception of reality, and hopefully by that time our historical personality has been disarmed.
Right. Now, well, we're not going to get into the HBM, the whole material of the HBM again, but the disarming of the historical personality, of the mechanicality of the machine, starts to occur when the essential self, when it can hold the presence and attention of the other space. And then the egos and powers of the mechanicality are subdued. These macro dimensions can feel so strange, so foreign, so terrifying. We might be left with a distinct impression that we have been here before, that we know this place, an eerie impression of deja vu, in which visual elements, sensory elements, all-encompassing cognitions awaken deep memories of a dim primal past. The familiarity is vague, disturbing, misleading. What is this? First he says this is foreign, terrifying, then he says something about deja vu. I don't get it. Gianjo, are you out there? Can you help us out?
I'm more in the dark than you are, David.
Well, that I don't know about, Harry, but let's just say that. So it is foreign, it's terrifying, and it's strange to the mechanicality of the machine. The historical personality says, I'm in a different place, I'm in a foreign place. Yet nevertheless, there's this sense of deja vu. And the deja vu is the essential self saying, oh, wait a minute.
Something recognizable.
Because what did we talk about last week? That we are drops, we are little moments of the absolute. We are little 1 inch, absolute, 1 minute part of it. And as such, when we start to awaken in that manner, something happens, and we have a question. That's right. Who said
foreign,
that? Jim,
foreign to the ego.
Jim says it's foreign to the ego, but not to the essential self. He's exactly right, Jim, because we're afraid to go into the bathtub, but once we're there, we love the water.
Yeah, well, that's the chronic, perhaps. Talking about that.
The chronic is a defense mechanism.
Yeah,
that
helps us get out of the awakened state.
Now, how about into?
And then, if we can sidestep it. So anyway, I thought that was important to expand a little bit on this sense of deja vu. So as the evening progresses, and if we are able to begin forming more as a team, and it feels more like that to you, does it feel comfortable in that manner, in the way of that unusual deja vu? Okay? Okay, jumping ahead a little bit. Humans, and I'm going to kind of jump through that paragraph in a strange way. Humans, you see that?
It's on 162 in this book here.
182. Humans possess the potential to perform higher dimensional functions, cross-dimensional voyaging capabilities open to, note, very few beings throughout the whole of creation. Wow.
Yeah, this is a great explanation here. I don't recall anything like this in the human biological machine.
No,
actually.
Nothing.
Although it certainly informs what it's very akin to is the creation story verbatim. You know, EJ's play, book and play about this issue, this conversation between the Lord and Archangel Gabriel about what's with these three-brained beings on Earth, what is so important about them, what's different, what's necessary, what's the big deal?
What's the big deal when there are these powerful angelic beings out there? And the difference is because the humans possess the potential to perform higher dimensional functions cross-dimensionally, which very few beings can. So we're kind of mobile in the labyrinth.
Yeah, that's what I got out of this.
Yeah, and I wish Harry's a bit familiar with the Tree of Life. I was going to bring an image of that again, that... and we'll see more discussion of it as we go through here. But in a certain way, the human has the ability to move throughout the labyrinth and thus, in a certain way, activating different parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, we're bringing material from last week into this week that it is our job, our task, to, it's called, alleviate the suffering of the Absolute. There's an exact point now where it says, this is what the human has that ability to do that. The natural inclination to use these skills for impersonal benefit, like all adult tastes, requires nurturing and cultivation. What do you think about that, this inclination to use? So we have that inclination. Everybody that's here, for some reason, is here.
Right.
It's axiomatic in a way. It's proved itself. It's we are here. We're therefore there's that inclination to use this.
But it's saying an unnatural inclination.
It is unnatural because Susan and you and I have had these discussions many, many, many a time. We're going against the grain of the human biological and opening up our angelic self. And when we open the angelic self up, the whole world is there. But how do you keep getting back there? I don't know if Hawk Lady is on, but the next phrase says what? Requires?
Nurturing and cultivation.
Does this make sense to us? Why would it be different than anything else of mastery that occurs in this particular labyrinth that we are in called the planet Earth? We are here.
Well, the tendency is for this, against nature focus or ability
inclination, you know, to get stamped out. I mean, this is going to get generally stamped out, trampled underfoot.
We're busy.
Throttled.
Well, and if it's not for the personal benefit, then why put out the effort?
Perfect, exactly. So, but practice it. And we've heard now many a time, because it's becoming more conversant in popular culture, just one moment, Molly, is this idea that to gain expertise, and this is actually throughout different fields, it requires roughly 10,000 hours of practice. When they look at the really superstar virtuosos in music or basketball or a performance of some sort, that's the number that starts to come up. So what if we wanted to form a mastery in cultivating what we're talking about tonight? Seems like we've got to put a little bit of work into it, right? Yes, Molly. Yes, please.
Yes, comment. Fear of breaking out of laws?
Becky. And
the loss of the ego's sense of being in control.
That was 10,000 hours. That's not too many. It's only 20 hours a week, but for 10 years. So,
well, you know, EJ has a great solution for this, which is that we're in a position, all of us here, every one of you that's listening to this, and all of us together, are in the unique position of being able to alter the past to make it so that we have put in those 10,000 hours.
Okay. There you go.
Didn't they always say it took 15 years? I've always heard that number.
Yeah,
you know, maybe
because you gain wisdom at the same time. It's not just a linear number of hours, but the deepening of practice brings wisdom with it.
Absolutely, the deepening of practice. And I don't know, maybe David can help me out. You know, I'm not remembering where the reference is, you know, in EJ's talks or in EJ's work. But, you know, this has to do with the process that Silverdale is always talking about, that in linking the pearls together, you know, and having more and more experience with the waking state, you know, with using the presence and attention and so on, you know, what happens is you're bringing moments in your life alive, and then you're bringing more and more, you're bringing swathes, you know, big swathes of your life alive, and then what happens is you bring moments of your life alive that you string together that are in your past, and then you bring swathes
of
experience and time that are in your past. And what it turns out, and I think that, you know, we can speak to this here in the school, and if some of you haven't, if this, again, sounds foreign or strange to you, this may actually come about for you too. See, like, I've discovered that I was reading science fiction when I was a preteen because my uncle was giving it to me, and that science fiction was written by people who were mentoring EJ as a child in his father's house in New York because of Galaxy Magazine, Horace Gold, all these connections. So it's like, you know, I discovered this school when I was in my late 20s. Well, maybe. Maybe that's when I first, you know, thought I discovered
this
school.
Maybe there was a predisposition to
it. Yeah, what was going on in my life from early childhood that was helping me log those 10,000 hours.
David, is it possible to resurrect earlier memories, earlier experiences?
That's what I was just going to ask you. Is there not indications, and Silverdale, you can help us too, in the Gurdjieffian literature about harvesting the past?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that we harvest past moments of awakening. And they not only do you harvest them, but they become part of the current portfolio, in a sense. I think I've mentioned maybe one of these shows, you know, I was raised Catholic, and I think, and for some reason, my older sister and I were in church, and it was empty. My parents had left us there, and I don't know why it came about. But it was just an empty, huge church, and with all the regalia of a Catholic church. About 10 rows before us was a solo man quietly praying. And we were sitting there in this quiet. After a few moments, this individual, his arms shot out and his head went back into a form of devotion. I was about 8 or 9 years old at that time, and boom, did that throw me into that space.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the mood of that today.
Yeah, there you go.
David, Mark Roach has a great comment.
Yes.
He said that I heard once that EJ advised for a particular someone to do readings for themselves, but themselves at a much younger age.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which would seem to indicate having an effect on our past.
Yeah, that's one of the techniques with using the American Book of the Dead, is that you may be reading for yourself at a time of trauma, at a time when you were deep in sleep, but you're addressing yourself as the Voyager in that segment of your life. Actually, we had somebody in our community who did that quite extensively. And what I recall him saying is that he felt that he addressed the trauma from an earlier time in his life, that it made a difference, you know, in his neural circuits or whatever. In other words, I know of at least one person who felt that reading to himself when he was basically, you know, lying deaf because.
Yeah.
Or some medical disaster, personal disaster, you know, that he actually altered his pattern from that trauma. You know, he changed it.
I believe about 2 days ago, I put on my reading altar, and I wanted to ask Molly this question. A picture of myself, I must be 3 years old, with my older sister too. The two of us sitting there in a, you know, stage portrait that you got when in 1954, five or whatever.
Right.
Cute little kid. I've seen the picture, and I've been reading. She's saying it's way good. And well, and what I think is to harvest those moments of awakening that as children we had that were, I don't know, it seems like we have to grow up to make it mature, to mature some of the experiences, but we can go back and gather some of that material too. There's a certain freedom that was available. I don't know how we got off on all of that, but...
Well, I think it's actually very relevant to this chapter. I was looking for that passage where he talks about, you know, the fact that your rules of behavior, like how you behave in voyaging in the labyrinth, are going to be, they can't possibly be the same in every instance, in every chamber. That sometimes this behavior is going to be the macro-dimensional one, or you know.
I'll jump to that. That's two pages ahead.
We're basically talking about that.
184 in the new version.
All right.
Middle of the page, and the paragraph starts with, "It would be most unwise."
Yeah, I got it. Yeah.
"It would be most unwise, unsound, inadvisable, actually blatantly stupid," comes to mind,
right,
"to assume that one totally predictable set of rules would apply unilaterally throughout the whole of it. What is appropriate in one space can be quite inappropriate in another."
Yeah, you know why I thought of that? What struck me about that is that this, you know, making a link to your essence, like your essence life as a child, that you're actually, we were much closer to this
kind of behavior and this kind of understanding intuitively. I mean, you know, without intellectualizing it, but you know, this is much more like a child. Well, you know, yeah, one day it may be a tantrum, and the next day everything's all roses.
David, what is the experience of the essential self for time? How does it experience it?
Well, my quick answer to that, and I'd love to get some guidance from you guys, is that I don't see it in time. I don't perceive it in a time manner. For me, for instance, that experience as an 8-year-old in that church, in the ambiance of devotion, is just as accessible and usable, in a sense, to me right now, Harry, as it
right.
was then.
That's out of time.
It's
actually.
Totally out of time, because it's right here, right now. It's inspiring me at this moment. I'm humbled by that sense of devotion at this second.
Yeah, and I was talking about another way that out of time things works is, I guess what I was trying to get at is this possibility that something that you're going to find yourself, that I'm going to find myself in, or we're going to find ourselves in next month or next year or something like that, that there'll be some background experience of preparation needed, and what we'll find out is that we will have prepared years ago for that experience. We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know now that what we did then was preparation, and it doesn't seem alive to us now, or let's say it's not present with us. But geez, something's, you know, we're at some point in the labyrinth, there's some twist or turn that we're having to take, and then it turns out, yeah, we need this response, this behavior, or we need this answer to a question. And it's, oh, and where do we pull that out? Well, we pull that out of something that we learned when we were 16 or 12 or 7. So,
well, and there's a certain childhood trusting that makes it okay to be in other spaces.
Nice. Nicely put. The child doesn't require linearity.
Yeah, right. Just rationality is not a big requirement.
It doesn't have that to impose upon its world, so it can flow in and out of that. And I'm always fascinated when I see really, really small kids, 2 or 3, and they're just sitting there, and there's maybe 2 or 3 objects in front of them, not necessarily toys, and suddenly they start making a world out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Building this, and this one talks to that one, and curious.
Well, yeah, I think there also is something childlike about this, the nature of the fluidity of slipping between chambers that EJ is describing here, you know, of the difference between the human, you know, that we were touching on,
yes.
and the macrodimensional being, which has a fixed morphology, is attached to the, you know, lives or exists in this one particular chamber. It is like we have this Voyager quality is like a child, but it's what, you know, that it may be, you know, anger or upset in one chamber and joy and happiness in another chamber and tranquility somewhere else, and you know that the mood or the emotion is not necessarily going to be for any particular reason. It's what conforms to the surround. It's what conforms to that area of voyaging. That seems childlike to me.
Well, and I think to be able to allow yourself just the freedom and the joy to explore that. I think as we take on more and more personality, that all gets too risky.
There is a joy. I think there is a joy. David read this passage about sort of like the fear, you know, of jumping off into that kind of surrender. But yeah, it's fluidity. I mean, there's a wonderful, unmachine-like sense of, you know, of that we can transform and morph and be fluid and so on. Because these chambers keep changing.
So I remember a few classes back, you had mentioned, David, something about going out in the world and just when you are in a present moment, look around and see who's there.
Yeah, I mean, that's
And the kids are there.
They'll notice you.
You can, yeah, the kids will just be right with you. So I don't know how that relates, but...
The way it relates is back to the paragraph we were reading called requires nurturing and cultivation. And I think Hawk Lady was interested in the 10,000 hours.
David, there's a very good comment by Becky Sunnybrook.
Great, Becky. Good. Would you please read it?
I'll be happy to. She says, children are the Tibetans, are the monks, who come to maintain the creation, and it goes on just under our very eyes. And adults do miss this. And then she goes on later to say, this potential is right there, and some adults, too, have realized the child in themselves, and they gain back that freedom.
Beautifully put. And
yeah, to
Becky,
become as a little child. Yeah.
Yeah, and Becky, if you're up to it, that would be a wonderful post on the site, wingsofchaos.com. That's a great, well put. There's so much in that, and the duty of maintaining this creation. Right? Thank you, Ganja.
You're welcome.
I'm going to jump ahead. I'm still on 184, and I'm jumping ahead a couple of paragraphs to an appropriate scouting team. See that?
Yeah, bottom of 164 in this book.
Okay. An appropriate scouting team is composed of the right combination of typicalities, an effective combination. And the word effective is the operant factor here, capable of producing an exact result in the macro dimensions, or able to access certain chambers, which then act as stepping stones to yet other macro dimensional chambers. Okay. I'd like some comments on that, and then I've got a comment or two.
David, I'm sorry, but what page is that on?
It's at the top of 185 in the new volume.
164 in the old.
Okay,
thank
you.
Bottom of 164.
Thank you, George.
An appropriate scouting team is composed of the right combination of typicalities. An effective combination, and the word effective is the operant factor here, an effective combination capable of producing an exact result in the macro dimension, or able to access certain chambers, which then act as stepping stones to other macro dimensional chambers.
Well, David, I take that simply that you wouldn't go to the orchestra if everybody played oboe.
That's
right.
And you have to have all the different functions represented. Everyone has different gifts. I would think it would be lopsided endeavor if everybody were the same way. It would be maybe boring.
Totally.
Yeah. And not effective. I mean, you know, he says, he has it in quotation marks, effective is the operant factor here. I think this is where... You know, this is one of the technology where the practice or setup for this
simulation of it, you know, comes in gaming, you know, in the online gaming that EJ's been doing, talking about teams of people, and people assume a different, you know, you can't have all barbarians or all sorceresses or whatever it is. You have a team made up of all of these different characters in the game.
There's a lot of people that are on the chat that I don't know. There, I don't know. Bag the food is still there. But, you know, and some of the people, I know a couple of people in Riverside. And I know some of the other people, all the ones, the three individuals on the phone I know. I know some of those typicalities. They're varied. They're so different. People here are varied. But nevertheless, our group is such a team. We are a team, a scouting team. And it's
well, it takes the intellectuals and it takes the sensing people and it takes all the different parts.
It takes the people that are quiet and attentive. And as we learned a few paragraphs ago, where he said, as long as you are attention and presence, then you are conformable to the space. So our group is configured. Our group is configured. And what is it that our group does? We get to this space. This is the space that we get to. Okay? And from here, we are, and as Becky, I think you get this very well, is that we're gaining something here, a little piece of something, and then we go about our world tomorrow. Okay? Take a little slice of this with you. And take that into that space. Weird.
No.
Okay.
No, I think Susan was suggesting that we're something of a study group here, so that we're performing a particular function. Let's say this tracking through these text and through these teachings and so on. But I mean, at the same time, we have quite a lot of different typicalities represented, I think.
Mark.
And there is a potential for us to travel in this medium, just like in music, let's say just as in music or in the video game.
And it's a particular signature that we will leave, and that signature is we are finding our way to this chapter. And in finding our way to the chapter, we're kind of blazing a pathway. We're blazing a pathway because the next set of people that do this, that pathway will be there a little bit clearer, more clearly. All right?
David, I have always thought that our work is more than just a study group. It's become in the last year a clear working group.
Yeah, I don't want to use the word study group because of the intellectual connotation that it has. But because a big part of it for me is the coming together electrically that we have when we are together in this way. And I sense so clearly that mood, and it's not just in this room. It reaches beyond. Okay.
We're spread out a bit.
We are. But it's our attention and presence together in this focal point that makes this happen. This is the thing that happens in that space. Okay? We don't need to define it, by the way. It doesn't need to be defined with in a linear manner, but I do, it does need to be, I like to just point to it. jumping ahead a paragraph then. When a small but effective group of voyagers successfully traverses a difficult sector of the labyrinth, team effort determines how well the group does, even if each individual member can't do what others can do. What does that mean? Team effort. We work together as a team, and we share what we can at each moment. Some people make comments on the log. Some people are notating things in themselves. That is helpful for all of us. Even some people can speak it out.
Other way of, let's say a shorthand way of summarizing that paragraph would be that this, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. You know, the formula here.
Absolutely.
The formula is that you put together all of these typicalities and then you get something that the individuals can't do.
The team acts to share the living, waking state on the macro-dimensional level, which, when shared equally rather than left to one, makes work possible. Okay? So these are the opportunities we have, and this is why our uniqueness, we happen to be invoked as human beings, and that brings unique qualities forth, unique qualities that we can work together. What an unusual thing. We can actually work together, and that's what we're doing here. We're working together for this. And then each person will go out and take a little bit of that. And I also have to, I look around, and I know several people, the jobs that they have. Some people are doing body work by, you know, certain kinds of body work. Another person is a healer, is working to become more of a healer. Other people like to be counselors. And I look around the group. There's a lot of people that tend to be in the service areas, Ivan, that want to be in that area, are people of this particular group. And I, like I say, I don't know what some of the people that are new to this, new to me anyway, I don't know what they do. I think a bag of food, I think we know what he does, but... Yeah, I assume so. I don't know. But if there's this sense of wanting to share this, and we can. That's part of the formula of the nurturing and cultivation. Take it on the road. Take it out there and do something with it.
Well, and I think we're practicing to be of service on a higher level.
Yes. So, Silverdale, what does that mean to us then, to be of service on a higher level?
Boy, Dave, through our own efforts, and our own transformation and evolution, we become aware of what is what would be helpful to others. And this book is a good example of how EJ has remarkably documented a map or some clues to how we can evolve ourselves. So that's what service is for me. Achieving certain milestones that enable you to participate with others for their benefit as well.
What would it mean? I'm thinking of you in particular, but I'm not necessarily addressing this just to you, Silverdale, but what does it mean? What could it mean? Let's take this on the road. Right now there's a particular sense and a particular mood amongst our team of voyagers. What would it mean to take that on the road?
Perhaps to spread the mood around.
How would you do that, though? What's the first step you would do?
You would be there first.
Called attention and presence.
Right.
Invoke that attention and presence. But you would do it in the world, right?
Right, and talk to the cashier. I mean, you can have eye contact with people in the grocery line.
Yeah, you can invoke presence. You can invoke the waking state as often as you can remember to do so.
So if you're sitting there,
you can do that.
There's 10 people behind you. You're in a hurry. You got to get going. How can you possibly have time at that minute for the cashier? I don't get it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you just make a joke.
That's funny.
Well, you just say something that lightens it up because you are, in fact, already a prisoner of the line.
Yeah. You're a prisoner of the line. But we have the hint. We have some sense of how to invoke attention and presence. So if you have the sense of how to invoke attention and presence, then you're in that line at that moment, in the chaos of all of that. In one moment, you can do that for that one moment. Is that right?
Sometimes.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, sometimes. But that's called, you know, that's the practice part. That's the 10,000 hours.
Keep the angel and the animal in physical contact at all times.
Mm-hmm.
That's a useful thing for me to remember.
Nice to put. Because we're getting to a point where we're able to do that. If we're able to do that,
more so.
We're more and more able to do that. Then it starts to also carry part of the weight of obligation. You might be the only prisoner in that line that can invoke a moment of freedom, Susan.
Well.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we were at the store just a couple days ago, and the cashier was just having a very bad interaction with the lady in front. And then when we came in, my sister said something that just brought her to her own humanness, and she just started to sparkle again.
Nice.
You could see the change.
And I think it has to be effective in the way we're talking about. It means you have to do more work. You have to do more work than you're doing now. You have to work to get into that space of attention and presence, not float along in the enormous ego of the mechanicality of the machine. But we have to do more work, and we can do that work. It's not simple to do what we're talking about, but the prize is great. The diversity of macro-dimensional chambers is unlimited, both in external and internal aspects. Mood, aroma, lighting, ambience, texture. Each voyager will have a unique way of presenting to and functioning in the macro-dimensional state and its unique and disturbing sensations according to your training, your typicality, and expendability, a subject we generally avoid.
Right.
Oh, gosh.
Well, invisibility.
A great talent, a high level of skill in being expendable.
Yeah, right, sure.
Fastening our psycho-emotional seatbelts and abandoning the safety and comfort to the primate level, we might find ourselves swamped and barely able to move within a dense, heavy electrical field. And then, just as suddenly, the atmosphere changes and we are struck by a cold, chilling dampness coming from seemingly nowhere. A moment later, we find ourselves surrounded by familiar landscapes, dissolving, not quite as gradually as we'd like, into endless, mysterious, interweaving caverns, reaching into an unfathomable depth of distant darkness. I'm going to close with reading the next paragraph. It's
we're going to continue. We better continue this chapter next week.
We'll go again next week.
Yeah,
but this next paragraph is very, very important. So while the chambers themselves have objective existence in the fact that they are crystallizations of fundamental notes within periodically recurring fundamental chords obeying the laws of harmony, our perception of them is entirely or almost entirely subjective. Even so, they can be classified, albeit artificially, by comparative plasticity, electrical density, resistance to movement, effects of color and light, sound reverberation, distortion patterns, degree of connectivity and reciprocity of objects and observers, presence or absence of spatial and communication impedance, and predominant moods, all measured against a single known and well-examined standard, which we have developed in our preparatory work prior to serious labyrinthoaging, which of course does not preclude our early exploratory and experimental voyages, which are unavoidably steeped in ignorance and imaginative fictioning, of course. And with this in mind, restricted to small tentative ventures into the uncharted wilderness of nearby macro dimensions. Huge, huh? But that list, and I was actually thinking that that list would be important to write down. Plasticity. In some of the chambers that we are in, and even the ones we've been in this class, but certainly in ones that we've been in the school, there's a sense of it. There's a plasticity to it. So each of these elements, electrical density, we understand that. Resistance to movement. Sometimes you can't move. And other times there's a fluidity of movement. Colors, light, sound, distortion, degree of connectivity. Sometimes you feel totally connected to either everyone in the space or to the universal. Now, this is an interesting, the reciprocity of objects and observers. That's a rare one, but
that's a key one, I think.
It's very unusual when it occurs. Say more about it then, Harry.
Yeah, how else could you describe that, Harry?
Well, reciprocity of objects and observers, that means there's basically no difference. So you're living in a nonlinear dimension, that's basically it. Everything that we see, all phenomena, is illusion.
It is you and I am it.
Yeah, but you're also merging with it. It's like you're having a tendency to merge with it as you're perceiving it. Eh?
Right.
Like you are what you perceive.
Yeah.
I would say that some of these items in this list are the subtle signs. You know, it could be characterized as the subtle signs, and some of them are the more frightening ones. So let's say the not so subtle signs.
Well,
that's some of them are pretty imposing, let's say, on your mood or atmosphere.
Well, the list isn't made by the human, by the historical personality. It's dictated by the by the space itself.
Yeah. Sort of Voyager experiences.
So we're now into a realm in this chapter. I don't know, I mean, Harry and George are the two of the most read individuals I've ever met. And have you read anything like this anywhere else?
Not this kind of detail.
That's
no, this is pretty extraordinary. It makes you want to meet the man who wrote it.
Yeah, exactly. It's real detailed shamanism or mystical experience.
But someone
techniques.
Willing to detail out that much about that kind of a space is a true gift. And that's the gift that we have before us with this chapter. So in a certain way, that part is an introduction. That's the first half of the chapter in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
So reread it again, absorb it. The more important, absorb the space that this particular team of Voyagers has brought together. This particular team has brought us to this space. Absorb that as well. And next week, we'll continue and complete chapter 15 on Wednesday night. So thank you so much for coming. And we'll look forward to seeing you next Wednesday.
Yeah, and let's post some of those.
Thank you, David, Ivan, everyone.
Yeah.
Welcome back, Harry.
Good to be here.
Good night, all.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Very nice class.